Now, this is the sign that I would give. Now, handily enough, this looks just like what you would do if you were being held up, right? But actually, this is much older. I mean, this isn't just since the 19th century. You start out like this, and then gradually, you bring your hands down into this position. And then finally, your hands end up basically in the same gesture as you would be making if you were doing the sign of a master mason. Now, but this all kind of flows together, and I'm going to try and do it for you as well as I can. There are also words that go with this, okay? And here's how it goes. You go, O Lord, my God, is there no help for the widow's son? So, O Lord, my God, is there no help for the widow's son? And if you were a mason, and you heard those words spoken like in a dark alley or when you were out walking at night or something, you would be obligated by an oath to go and help that guy. What's interesting, another little bit of Masonic history, is that Joseph Smith, the founder of the Mormon Church, was a Mason. And when he was being shot by a mob in Carthage Jail in Carthage, Illinois, he was at a window trying to kind of climb out of the jail because people were firing at him from within the jail, and people were also firing at him from outside the jail. Supposedly, his last words were, my Lord and my God, according to the Mormon Church. But according to eyewitnesses, they were, O Lord, my God, is there no help for the widow's son? And what's interesting even further is that a lot of people have speculated that many of the fingers that were on those triggers shooting Joseph Smith had Masonic rings on them. Because he had stolen the secrets of Masonry and run off and started his own Masonic temple, which is now called the Mormon Temple. Because all the secrets that are inside the Mormon temple are just, you know, warmed over masonry. That's all it is. Okay. Then, next we'll go to tokens. And what do we mean by tokens? Well, these are the secret handshakes. And this is the way Masons may know one another in the dark as well as the light. Now, here's an example. This is the pass grip of an entered apprentice. And how you do it is you make a pressure on the first knuckle with your thumb. Then the grip of an entered apprentice, this is first degree, is to have a pressure in the hollow between the two knuckles. Then second degree is pressure on the second knuckle. The grip of second degree is the hollow of the second and third knuckle. The third degree pass grip is the third knuckle. Then we have this. This is the third degree grip, which is called the strong grip of the lion's paw, or the grip of the lion of the tribe of Judah, or a master mason grip. And here you'll see it's kind of like, you almost like you go like Mr. Spock, and you go like this. And that is the grip by which the Grand Master Hiram Abiff was raised from the dead. So this is the fundamental degree of a master mason. Now, there are grips for every one of these degrees, but we aren't going to go into all of them because, frankly, I don't remember all of them, and you'd probably be bored silly by the time I was done. But we are going to talk about some of the jewels that master masons wear by which they can recognize one another. This is probably the best-known symbol of all masonry, and I'm sure all of you have seen this either on buildings or on bumper stickers or on lapels or whatever. This is the ultimate symbol of the Masonic Lodge, of the Blue Lodge. And you see there the square and the compass. This is the square, this is the compass, and then, of course, the letter G. Now, if you ask the Mason, what does that mean? What's that G stand for? He might say, I can't tell you, it's a secret. Or if he's being very, very forthcoming, he might say, well, it stands for geometry. Or he might even say, it stands for God. However, if you read the books that are in the Mason's library, and every Mason has access to these books, you will find out that this G actually stands for the principle of generativity, which is just a big word for the power of human beings to reproduce themselves. And that makes sense, because if you read in those same books, you'll discover that the square and compasses symbolize the male and female reproductive organs. So that's what this actually symbolizes. Isn't that spiritual? Now, I'm going to show you a very secret symbol in masonry that most of you, if you've seen it, you probably never knew what it meant. This will often be seen on like either cars or a lapel or a tie tack or something like that. This is called the two-ball cane, okay? And it doesn't mean the guy's in the golf. I mean, I know some people look at that and they go, oh, it's a golf club. But no, it's a two-ball cane. And it's a joke. It's a pun. Because the password of a master mason is Tubal-Cain, who is a character out of Genesis 3. He's the first artificer in cunning metalwork, and he's considered to be the very first mason even before the flood. But let me show you a little trick here. Let's say, for example, you turn this upside down. It gives you a clue to the identity of the real god of masonry. Okay. Then another thing that's very common, I'm sure some of you have seen these, are the wearing of rings. Masons will often wear rings or other jewelry to let other masons know that they are in fact masons. There's not a lot more I can say about that, but those are some typical Masonic rings. Now this is a symbol which is out of the York Rite fourth degree. Now, I apologize for how weird this symbol looks. I tried to take, you know, Stan was talking about how hard it is, you know, spiritual warfare, putting together one of these talks. I had to take 5 or 6 pictures of this to get one that looked this good. And it doesn't look good at all, I know, but I apologize for that. This is the sign of the Mark Master degree. And you'll notice, well, you won't notice because you can't see it, but around this circle here are letters. HTKSSTKS. And I get all these letters from people writing me and saying, what does this mean? What does this mean? Well, here's the big secret. This is the stamp of Hiram Abiff, okay? This circle that you see in the center of this odd-shaped thing. And it says, based those stand for, Hiram the widow's son sent to King Solomon. So that's what those words, those letters mean, those initials. Now, you'll notice it has an odd shape. And that's because this is a stone which the builders rejected that becomes the headstone of the corner. Again, another place where they take the glory away from Jesus and apply it to Hiram Abiff. But what the story behind this is supposedly after Hiram Abiff was killed, and we'll get into why he was killed later, they found this stone laying in the rubble of the temple when it was about to be completed. And they looked at it and they said, this stone isn't true. By that they mean the angles are wrong. It's not right angles. And they said, this stone is worthless, and they threw it away. The stone which the builders rejected, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So later on they finish the temple, and they're putting the arch up. And they look and they say, there's no stone to hold the arch together. And then they remembered, ah, that stone. And so they go and they get it, and it becomes the headstone of the corner. And that's the whole point between the mark, behind the Mark Master degree. Okay. Now, this is another part of the York Rite, which you'll see. This is the commandery. The Knight Templar commandery. And you'll notice the motto there is in hoc signo vinces. That's Latin. It means in this sign, conquer. And basically, the idea behind that is that supposedly Constantine, who was the first pope, he gets up there and he's fighting this battle at one point. He's not a Christian at this time. And he's losing the battle. He's the emperor of Rome. And supposedly this sign appears in the heavens of a cross. And underneath it are the words, in hoc signo vinces, and this sign conquer. And so he went and painted crosses on all of his soldiers' shields, and then they won the battle. And then Constantine supposedly converted to Christianity. There's a lot more to that, but basically if you study the archaeology behind this, you will find that the cross that was painted was not the cross of Christianity. It was an Egyptian cross or an ankh. But that is the story behind that. Now, this is supposedly the Christian degree of masonry. But as we'll find out later, it's about as Christian as nothing. Now, this is the Scottish Rite symbol. This is a symbol of the 32nd degree of the Scottish Rite, which is the other branch of masonry. And you notice the motto there, Spes mea in Deus est. That means, my hope is in God. That sounds very pious, doesn't it? But you'll notice this strange eagle. He's got 2 heads. You don't know whether he's coming or going. And you'll notice this little top knot up here. Notice those little top knots on the 2 eagles. Those are going to be very important later, so don't forget those. Okay? Then another one we're going to look at. This is a symbol of the mystic shrine. And you'll notice here several important things. First of all, this is the scimitar, or the distinctive sword of Islam. Now, the scimitar is a very sharp blade that's basically used to behead infidels. You see, Muslims had a very unique way of soul winning. They'd come up to someone and they would say, I want you to become a Muslim. Will you submit to Allah? And if you said no, they'd cut your head off. They got a lot of converts that way. Today, instead of using scimitars, they tend to blow people up a lot. But it's the same idea. It's called jihad, holy war. And if you die in the service of Allah, you will go straight to paradise. Now, the moon is because Allah is a moon god. How many of you knew that? Allah is not the supreme father god that we think he is. He is not the same as the God of the Bible, which everybody wants you to think. No, no, no. Allah is a rock. Allah is a rock and is a moon god. And, of course, this is the star of the goddess. So you have the moon god and the star goddess. What could be simpler? Now, you'll see more quickly here, or more readily, the rest of the symbol on this one. This is the infamous fez, which is the sign of a shriner. And you notice here, you can see a little better that this is actually a little Egyptian head, like of an Egyptian king, and that's supposed to be the pagan god Osiris. And of course, if you know your Bible, you'll understand how well God feels about the Egyptians. Egypt in the Bible, the Old Testament, is a symbol of carnality and depravity. Now, this is a symbol of the Eastern Star. And you'll notice that it is above other things, and we're going to look at this a lot more closely later, but for now, I'll just point out that it looks very much like a pentagram, which is a symbol of witchcraft, and it's turned upside down, meaning the one point is pointed downward, and that is uniquely a symbol of Satanism. It's a symbol which is used to cause the kingdom of Satan to be manifest in this world today. Okay, we talked about signs, tokens, now we're going to talk about words. These are the secret passwords of the three first degrees. The password for the entered apprentice degree is Boaz, for second degree is Jacob, and for third degree is Tubal-Cain. Now, we'll talk about the main word of the Masons later. But for now, what I want to go into is some other ways that Masons might identify each other. Let's say, for example, I heard that there was a Mason running a store downtown. It was like, say, a jewelry store or something. And he gave discounts if he knew you were a Brother Mason. So I would walk in there, and I would say something like this. I'd talk to the manager, and I'd say, I see you're a traveling man. And he would say, yes, I travel from west to east and from east to west again. And you would say, in search of what? And he would say, in search of that which was lost. And then you would know that you were both Masons, and you'd get the discount. Another way you might do that is to come into the store and say, I've heard that I can get a square deal here. Because, see, Masons always deal with one another on the square. Another way is to come in and say, do you know the widow's son? Now, of course, if you say this to somebody who's, you know, not a Mason, they just kind of look at you, okay, right, you know, why don't you go get a life, fella? And that's the end of it. But if he's a Mason, he knows that you are a Mason and you'll get whatever benefits you're looking for. And basically, that's how much business is done. In a couple minutes, we're going to get into that. We're going to talk about how Masons often use Masonry to grease the wheels of business and of making of deals and things like that. Okay, we've just been talking about the signs, the tokens, the words, the points of our entrance. The last one is probably the hardest to understand just from the way the term is, but points of your entrance is the way that a Mason stands, the way he approaches the altar in the east. And if you look, what you see up on the screen right now is the way an entered apprentice would approach the east. He has the heel of his right foot into the hollow of his left, at right angles to one another. And that is a sign of an entered apprentice. Now, understand something. If I were to stand in a courtroom before a judge who was a Mason and put my feet in this way, he would know that I was at least an entered apprentice Mason. And he would be required by his oath to give me preferential treatment over my adversary in the courtroom. Now, This is the way a master mason does the same thing. Now here you'll notice the feet are at right angles to each other, the heels touching together. And this is the way a master mason would stand and approach the altar. And again, the same thing applies. If this person were to go into a court or even like a job interview perhaps and want to let people know that he was a mason, he might stand this way and not have to say a word. It's interesting, though, that Proverbs chapter 6 and 12 says this: a naughty person, a wicked man, walketh with a froward mouth. He winketh with his eyes, he speaketh with his feet, he teacheth with his fingers. Just what we're talking about here. And people say the Word of God isn't inspired. Okay. Now, let's talk about the good old boy network. Let's talk about the craft and business. Masonry has been around a long time, and it has been used as a way to get ahead in business for a long time. Masonry began with the Stonemason Guild, and may surprise you to learn that it was just like, for example, the Carpenters Union that we have today, or the Plumbers Union, or even the Stonemasons Union, except for one difference. Back in the Middle Ages, nobody could read. So, for example, if you showed up on a job site and the foreman said, "Are you a master mason?" and you whipped out your card and showed it to him, he couldn't read it. That's a problem. So how do you let someone know that you're a master mason if they can't read? Well, the answer is simple. You walk into the job site, you say, "I'm a master mason." You can either use some of these little handshakes, or you can simply do this. You go like this and like this, and the guy knows you're a master mason. And that's all there is to it. You got the job. Just as good as a dues card. Now here's another question. It's more contemporary. Let's say your boss is a mason. Let's say that you're up for a promotion and the guy that's competing with you for that promotion is a Freemason. Who do you think is going to get that job? I'll give you a clue. It ain't going to be you. Another thing that Masons do is they use the lodge to network. And this is especially the case with doctors and lawyers. Because doctors and lawyers, it used to be their codes of ethics would not allow them to advertise. I know all of you are probably sick of seeing commercials for lawyers now. But, you know, back in my day, when I was, say, maybe 20, 25 years old, lawyers were not allowed to advertise. And so the only way they could advertise was through the lodge or through similar fraternal organizations. They would develop networks, and that's how they would get referrals. So then we have the whole thing of discounts. I've already alluded to that, that, for example, you can walk into a store, and if you're a mason, you say certain little funny words, and they'll give you a discount. And then, of course, the question becomes, how many large corporations are being run today by masons? Many, many of them. Just one example. How many of you know that Dave Thomas, the guy that owns Wendy's, he's a 33rd degree mason? Might want to rethink where you buy your hamburgers. Anyway, and it's a shame because I always kind of liked that guy. Anyhow, then we've got the lodge and the law. This is even getting more sinister here, folks. Because of what I just mentioned, this whole issue of how lawyers used to build clients, there's always been a close association between the lodge and the law. Large numbers of lawyers and judges are masons. In fact, in the old days, almost all lawyers were masons. That's a little bit less true today, but and especially obviously if you're a female lawyer, you're not a mason. But many judges and many lawyers are masons. Additionally, throughout Europe and America, a disproportionate number of law enforcement people are masons. In London, it was essentially required that one be a mason to advance in Scotland Yard of the Metropolitan Police. Untold hundreds of sheriffs in this country and police chiefs are Masons. J. Edgar Hoover, for example, was a 33rd degree Mason. This left a solid Masonic stamp on the FBI, which persists to this day. Now, all of this sounds only vaguely disturbing, but for one thing, and that is the content of the oaths that are given in Masonry. For example, when you take the third degree oath of a master mason, one of the codicils in that oath says that you will warn a brother master mason of approaching danger so that he can get out of the way. Now, let's say you're in the prosecuting attorney's office, or let's say you're a police officer, and you learn that a Brother Master Mason is going to have a warrant served on him for his arrest. You're obligated by an oath to go and warn that Mason so he can skip town before he's thrown in the clink. Another thing is that you will notice in the third degree oath that you swear that you will keep the secrets of a Master Mason inviolate within your heart, murder and treason excepted. That means any crime except murder and treason, you are obligated by that blood oath to cover. If he's a rapist, if he's a child molester, if he's a thief, if he's an arsonist, any of that stuff, you have to conceal that. You are not allowed to talk about that. And that's true even if you're an officer of the court. Now, it gets even worse. Let's say you're a seventh degree Royal Arch Mason in New York Rite. Then the oath is that you have to keep the secrets of a Royal Arch companion inviolate within your heart, murder and treason not accepted. In other words, you've got to keep everything secret. That guy could be an axe murderer. He could be a traitor to the United States like the esteemed Mason Benedict Arnold was. And the Masons would not be able to reveal that. This is pretty serious stuff. Now, let me give you a couple of examples of this. In many communities, especially in the South, try to bring a case against a Mason. You will not get very far, even in the so-called Bible Belt. True story, the boys and the juvenile court judge. There was a juvenile court judge in the Pacific Northwest who had a predilection for little boys. And basically, he presided over a lot of these juvenile delinquent type hearings, and many times, if he liked the boy would get off in exchange for meeting with the judge in chambers and exchanging certain favors, shall we say. Well, this fellow, they kept trying to bust him, and because he was surrounded by Masons, both in the courts and in the law enforcement, they would always cover up for him. Finally, one of the boys went and titled to the newspaper, and fortunately, the fellow who was the reporter was not a Mason. The story got out. The fellow apparently killed himself, but broken rocks were found in his pocket. Talk more about those broken rocks later. Another true story. There was a financial scam artist in London, and basically, he was bilking all sorts of people out of money. And there was a Scotland Yard officer who was trying to nail this guy, and they couldn't get him, and they couldn't get him because the Masons in the yard and the Masons that were surrounding him were protecting him. Finally, the guy did manage to find enough evidence to convict the fellow, but guess what happened to the Scotland Yard official? He was almost busted, the meter maid. And they kept giving him the worst possible assignments, and finally the fellow actually had to resign. Then there's the case of the woman who was married to a Shriner. It was his second marriage. He was considerably older than she. She was a young, attractive woman. And he was a member of a very elite shrine organization called the Jesters. Now, if you know anybody who's a jester, be afraid. These are very creepy people. And what would happen in this particular woman's case, and I know it's not isolated because of some of the documents I have seen, every Friday night they would have poker. And he would tie his wife up on the bed, and all the other jesters would rape her. And there was nothing she could do about it. She went to the local police chief, and he was a Shriner. She went to the district attorney, and he was a Shriner. And finally, she was about to go higher than that, and a psychiatrist came to her and said, if you say one more word, we're going to have you locked up as a paranoid delusional, because I'm also a Mason. And you'll be locked up forever on my signature, and you'll never get out. She ended up having to flee the state. These are examples of how Masons can cause a miscarriage of justice. But here is probably the most celebrated example of this in the history of the West. Jack the Ripper, a Freemason? The answer to that question is yes, one way or another. Let me explain. For those of you that may not know, Jack the Ripper is probably the Western world's first known serial killer. He murdered 8 prostitutes in Whitechapel district of London in the year 1888, and he had the whole city of London terrified. This was Victorian England, mind you, and nothing like this had ever happened in the history of England that anybody knew of. And here's what happened. They mounted a huge investigation. The man in charge of the investigation was Police Commissioner Warren, who was a Freemason. At that time, the Prime Minister of England, as is often the case, was a Freemason. The heir presumptive to the throne of England, the Duke of Clarence, was also a Mason. And the physician to the royal court at the time, Dr. Gull, was a Freemason. Now, here's what actually happened. The eight women who were killed, if you study this, and I happen to have been, before I even became a Mason, I was kind of a Jack the Ripper buff. I'd read several of his the books about him and kind of studied up. And when I became a Mason, I realized that the way, the horrible way, these unfortunate women were murdered was in accord with Masonic ritual gestures. Just one of them had her throat cut from ear to ear. Another one had her bowels ripped out of her body and thrown over her left shoulder, and so on and so on. These were Masonic ritual murders. But why? Well, here's what happened. Believe it or not, the Duke of Clarence, who was second in line to the throne of England, had fallen in love with a prostitute named Annie Crooks. And he married this woman. Now, that was bad enough. But he had a child by her, a little girl. And this woman, horror of horrors, was a Roman Catholic. Now, if you understand the way the Parliament and the monarchy work in England, there is a law that no member of the royal family can ever marry a Roman Catholic because of the adversarial relationship that existed for centuries between the Church of Rome and the Church of England. And so this would have shaken the very foundations of the throne of England. So Dr. Gull, who was a physician and surgeon, had Annie Crooks committed to a mental institution where she died by suicide several months later, because of course in those days mental hospitals were not really Club Med, not that they are today either. The little girl, who was two or three at most, was placed in a Catholic orphanage. But every woman in Whitechapel, from Catherine Beddoes to Mary Jane Kelly, that knew of the wedding and knew Annie Crooks, were horribly murdered to conceal the secrets of a brother master mason. Now, you'll notice the thing up there on the board says the Jewess will not be blamed for nothing. Now, you might wonder, what the heck does that mean? Well, this phrase was scrawled on an alley in Whitechapel during the height of the hysteria. What does that phrase mean? Well, believe it or not, Police Commissioner Warren ordered it immediately struck from the alley. It was taken off the alley, erased. He claimed it was because he did not want to have anti-Semitic riots, because he was afraid people would believe the Jews were out there killing prostitutes. Actually, that was a lie. This term, Jewess, is actually a Masonic code word. It refers to the three ruffians who murdered Hiram Abiff, Jubalah, Jubalah, and Jubalum. And this was a kind of roundabout way of saying the Masons will not be blamed for nothing. Just to hold the hands of
with you. The smoke is rising in the shadows overhead.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing: knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2-KEEP-IT-TODAY.
Now, if you want any further proof of this, I would direct your attention to what Jack the Ripper originally called himself, because he wrote letters describing his atrocities. And obviously, whether it was Dr. Gull or whether it was an accomplice who worked with Dr. Gull, we don't know. But we do know this. Many people have remarked that the killings themselves were obviously done by someone who was a surgeon. The cuts were done very, very carefully and with an extremely profound knowledge of human anatomy. Anyway, the first time, before Jack was called Saucy Jack or Jack the Ripper, the first nickname he gave himself was Leather Apron. Now, every Mason, when they are made a Master Mason, is given a white lambskin or leather apron. That is the badge of a Mason. Now, this illustrates how Masonry can be used and is often used to conceal crimes, even for a century. Now, let's move on. We'll talk now about the craft and politics, everybody's favorite subject. Most politicians, as everybody has probably observed, tend to be lawyers. As we've already discussed, most lawyers are Masons. Therefore, a lot of politicians are Masons. Many heads of state are Masons. At least 17 presidents of the United States have been Freemasons. Let's talk about the Revolutionary War period. I've already mentioned that Benjamin Franklin was a Mason. Franklin, Benedict Arnold, Paul Revere, George Washington, possibly Jefferson, we don't know that for sure. John Adams was a strong anti-Mason, though. Now, let me talk for a moment about Washington, though. The Masons make an incredible amount of hay out of the fact that Washington was a Mason. I mean, I'm sure some of you have even seen, like, around the time of Washington's birthday, they have ads in the paper, you know, showing Washington presiding over the Grand Lodge and so on and so on. Let me tell you something. All of that is basically fiction. I document in my book, Masonry Beyond the Light, the fact that, yeah, Washington was a Mason. He joined when he was an officer in the British Army in his youth, dare I say, before he knew better. Additionally, in those days, if you wanted to get anywhere in the officers' corps of the British Army, you had to be a Mason. But I have a letter documented in my book that proves that at the end of his life, Washington wrote a clergyman, and he said that he had not been inside of a Masonic lodge for 30 years. So much for him being a devout Mason. I think he basically figured out early on that there was nothing that he needed to belong to and basically just walked away from it. There was no teaching in those days that you had to renounce Masonry or do anything like that, and so he just basically stopped going. And he made that very clear. Plus, on his deathbed, he denounced Masonry because he had discovered it had become a tool for bringing the Illuminati into America. How about 20th century politics? Look at all these darlings of the conservative right. Jesse Helms, Bob Dole, Strom Thurmond, Ronald Reagan, who was made an honorary Mason, Gerald Ford, Harry Truman, and Franklin D. Roosevelt. All of these people were high-level Masons, with the exception of Reagan, who was just made an honorary Mason. Now, think of that. All of these people, except Reagan, have taken Holy Communion out of a human skull, because that's what's involved in being a 33rd degree Mason. And you would not believe the oath that these people have to take. They swear that they will work for the destruction of law, religion, and government. And then you wonder why this is so bizarre today in our government, our political system. Freemasonry has been called America's civil religion, and rightly so. You will often find Masonic worshipful masters laying the cornerstones for civic buildings. I'm sure some of your civic buildings, like post offices or courthouses, have had blessings by Masonic worshipful masters. And of course, a blessing from a worshipful master is like a curse. Then we have the nation's capital. This is a map of the nation's capital. And you will notice, I'm going to spin this a little here. This here is the Capitol itself. You'll notice the little horned goat guy there around the Capitol. Then here is the square. Here is the compass. One point of it is over the Jefferson Memorial. And conveniently, the other point of it is over the White House. Now, this shows it a little bit more clearly. Actually, that may be reversed, but I'm not going to mess with it. You'll see here we have an inverted pentagram pointing straight at the White House. You ever wonder why our president is having all of these problems? Then down the road a piece, just 13 blocks away from the White House, is the House of the Temple, which is the supreme headquarters of the Scottish Rite. Ever wonder, number 13? Well, we're going to talk a little more about that later. So you see here that, and the Masons brag about this. There are articles in Masonic magazines about how a Mason laid out Washington, D.C. A Mason laid down the architecture and everything for Washington, D.C. Okay, now we're going to talk about Masonry and the New World Order. For as long as the conspiracy has existed, which is basically since the Tower of Babel, that was the world's first United Nations. How many of you realize that? The Masons have been working to basically accomplish two things. The destruction of the worship of the true and living God on the one hand, and secondly, the establishment of a one world government and a one world religion. And if you notice, you see that even right in the Tower of Babel. If you read that chapter, Genesis 11, it talks about They say, let us build a tower and a city. The tower is a symbol of religious Babylon. The city is a symbol of political Babylon. And you put them together, and there's the New World Order. Now, since that time, down through the centuries, Masonry has worked either behind the scenes or even out in the open to try to destroy things for the church. Now, it started getting pretty obvious during the time of what is called historically the Enlightenment. Now, that was a period just after the Protestant Reformation in the early 1700s, where this new philosophy came about called the Enlightenment. And it was the idea that we didn't need faith anymore. We didn't need religion anymore. We had a new God rising. And that God's name? Science. That science could give us the answers. That logic and reason could give us all the answers we needed. And we no longer needed to have all of these other things going on. We no longer needed to have faith in this invisible God that could not be put in a test tube, so to speak, and measured. And so the Enlightenment came along, and that was followed very quickly on by the Illuminati coming on the scene. Two of the earlier members of the Enlightenment who were also Freemasons were Francis Bacon and Elias Ashmole. And what happened is Francis Bacon wrote a book called The New Atlantis. And that book was basically trying to evoke the spirit of the original continent of Atlantis. Now, some of you may know, some of you may not. Atlantis is a mythical continent that supposedly existed in the days several hundred years before Christ, and supposedly was like the Golden Age. I mean, it had great science, it had great philosophy, great occult powers, great technical achievements. And it was sunk under the sea because of its pride. Some people believe that that is a reflection of the Noahic flood in Greek myth. There may be other explanations. But what Francis Bacon wanted to do was create a new Atlantis on the American continent where Masonry and occultism could be practiced openly. The most obvious, and what I tell people, quite frankly, is that Masonry and Christianity have been struggling in this country for 200 plus years. It's kind of like Esau and Jacob in the womb fighting. And that conflict has never fully been resolved, even to this very day. And one of the earliest manifestations of this conflict was in what I call Satan's seal of approval, the Great Seal of the United States. I'm not going to go into a lot of depth on this, but let me just say this much. Down through the centuries, right from the year 1776, the United States began working on a seal. And this seal was usually worked on by committees that were composed predominantly of Masons. Now, down through the years, by the time we get up to this century, the seal was more or less obscure. But then Henry Wallace, Henry Morgenthau, and FDR, all Masons, decided they wanted to place this seal on the back of the dollar bill. And, of course, that's where it remains to this day. So in 1935, we had the Great Seal placed on the back of our dollar bill. Scottish Rite magazine brags about the number of Masonic attributions that are on the Great Seal's obverse. Now, by obverse, I mean the front of the seal. And you'll see there, for example, all of the numbers 13. That's a Masonic number, by the way. The number is 32, and we're going to actually get into this now. I'm going to put up a thing of the seal on the board. Several interesting coincidences, if you believe in such things. For example, there are 32 feathers in this wing for the 32 degrees of the Scottish Rite. There are 33 feathers in this wing for the 33rd degree. Down below, there are 9 feathers in the tail of the bird, contrary to what the Scottish Rite magazine, obviously in addition to being spiritually deceived, Masons can't count. There are 9 feathers in this tail, which represents the 9 degrees of the Arkwright. What could be simpler? So, then look at that eagle. What's the deal with the eagle? Well, we know it's a noble bird, but how many of you realize that for years, when this seal was first being created, Benjamin Franklin who was both an Illuminist and a Satan worshiper, sorry to tell you, and a Freemason, he lobbied for it being a phoenix instead of an eagle. He wanted this bird to be a phoenix. Now, what the heck is a phoenix? Well, the phoenix is an occult mythological bird that goes back to ancient Egypt, and it was called the Bennu bird. And the way it was distinctive about this bird is that every so often it would immolate itself. It would set itself on fire and be reduced to ashes. And then from the ashes it would spring, reborn, as a new, entirely new bird. And, of course, this was a symbol of death and resurrection, which is the core of the mysteries of Masonry. Now, I want to show you something. Remember I told you to pay attention to that top knot on the top of the eagles on the Scottish Rite symbol? Well, if you look at this very carefully on let me see, it would be this bird here. This is the way Franklin wanted the eagle to look. Now, this is the way the eagle actually looks. You'll notice that this eagle has a little top knot that is not really characteristic of the normal bird. Now, what I'm going to show you next is a Egyptian hieroglyph of the phoenix in human form. Notice what he's got on his head, a little top knot. This is, again, another indication of the occult level to which the seal sinks in terms of its symbolism. Now, let's talk about the reverse of the seal. First of all, if you look at the ranks of the pyramid on the seal, they relate to the satanic hierarchy. The unfinished pyramid in both architecture and in geometry is called a frustum. And one side of that pyramid would be called a trapezoid. You'll notice there that this is a trapezoid, this shape, and it's unfinished. You'll notice also that there are 13 ranks here. And then look at the all-seeing eye up there at the top. That all-seeing eye is not God, brothers and sisters. Masons would like you to believe that it is. This is their God, but it ain't my God. I'm sorry. If you study that symbol, that eye is actually called an Utchut eye or a Widget eye, and it's a symbol of the all-seeing eye of Osiris or Horus. See, my God is not a Cyclops. He has two eyes, not just one eye. And now down at the bottom here, you'll notice this interesting Roman numeral. If you add that up in the Roman numeral system, it comes up to 1776, which seems appropriate. You'll notice that above it says Anuit Chaptus, and then down below it says Novus Ordo Seclorum. That means this year begins the New World Order. Now, you might think, oh, that's okay, you know, that's America, right? We're the New World Order. No, America did not begin in 1776. Think about it. We hadn't even won the war yet. There were no Articles of Confederation. There was no Constitution. There were no states. This does not refer to America, my friends. On May 1st, 1776, the Illuminati was formed. That is the New World Order, not America, I'm afraid. They just want to plant the New World Order here, but that is not the New World Order. Now, I'm going to put up briefly, this is how that pyramid can be decoded in terms of the satanic hierarchy. And you'll notice down here at the bottom are the conventional degrees of the York and Scottish Rite, all the way up to the Supreme Council of Grand Sovereign Inspectors General. Then above it, we have the various satanic orders, some of which, in fact, I'm sad to say, most of which I was a member of, all the way up to the nine unknown men, the seven, and then the great architect of the universe himself, Lucifer, the limitless light of nothingness. That's his title. And I think it's rather appropriate, actually. Anyway, and that is what that seal means. That is what that all-seeing eye refers to. That is a symbol, ultimately, of Lucifer. Now, let's talk about this conspiracy in a little more detail and depth. Basically, all of you, or at least I would think some of you, have heard of a document, an historical document called the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. Now, that document was used by a lot of people, including Hitler, to blame the Jews for virtually everything that was wrong in the conspiracy, that they were causing all of the troubles that were in the world. Unfortunately, they got the wrong elders and they got the wrong Zion. The actual thing that we're talking about here is the Priory of Zion. And notice how it's spelled up there. It's not spelled with a Z the way the Bible spells it, at least the way the King James Bible spells it. It's spelled with an S, the way the Catholic Bible spells it. And that's for a reason. The Priory of Zion is a fairly secret, until maybe the last 10 years or so, high-level Masonic Rosicrucian-type body. And the Priory of Zion believes that it is the keeper of the Holy Grail. This group believes that it has the bloodline of Jesus Christ, that Jesus had children by Mary Magdalene, and that down through the centuries it has guarded that bloodline. And that many of the, like, for example, the Merovingian kings and some of the other kings down through the century, right up today, and of course you may know this, that Prince Charles and Queen Elizabeth claim to be descended all the way back to King David. They believe they have this royal bloodline. And this group is planning on trying to destroy biblical Christianity by the year 2000. And the way they're going to do it, see, they teach in their inner circles, and now this has all kind of been revealed by a series of books, beginning with the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail, back around 1986, 1987, that Jesus did not die on the cross, that he was spirited away from the tomb, that he married Mary Magdalene, and they ran off and lived happily ever after, and had children, and that he died a happy old age. And down through the years, these descendants of Mary Magdalene today are part of the reigning houses of Europe and the reigning houses of Freemasonry. And they believe they will very soon rule the world. But here's the interesting thing. The way they believe they're going to destroy Christianity forever is sometime in the next couple of years, this is the planning, and God can always interfere with these plans, is they're going to produce the bones of Jesus. Or at least what they claim are the bones of Jesus. I don't know how they're going to prove that. And they believe that will destroy Christianity, along with the revelation that Jesus was married and that he never rose from the dead. So this is part of the plan. And unfortunately, you know, they are moving ahead with their plan. I know God, though. I know he can certainly do something to prevent that. But ultimately, this is what's going to happen if they have their way. Now, if you want to understand the philosophy of this group and what they want to do, the highest levels of Masonry, don't look at the American Revolution, because while there were Masons involved in it, it was very biblically based. Look at the French Revolution. The French Revolution was, in fact, a textbook case of what the Illuminists and the Masons would like to do if they get their hands on our government. Now, if you know anything at all about the French Revolution, you know it was very awful. They had the Reign of Terror, where thousands and thousands of people were sent to Madame la Guillotine for a very close shave. And clergy, whether Protestant or Catholic, were killed without mercy. Churches were destroyed. Monasteries were destroyed. Churches were defaced. For example, Notre Dame Cathedral, which is noted throughout the world for the beauty of its architecture, which is Masonic, by the way, was defaced. A half-naked prostitute was enthroned on the altar as the goddess of reason, and a crown was placed on her head and a burning torch was placed in her hand. This, my friends, is the order of the origin of the Statue of Liberty. She is not the goddess of liberty, she is the goddess of reason, as opposed to religion, because everybody knows that no reasonable person would believe in God. No reasonable person would believe in Jesus Christ rising from the dead. Now, would they? And so when you see Lady Liberty in New York Harbor, realizing that the light that she is raising is the light of Lucifer, not the light of liberty. And if you want further proof of this, let me point out two things. Number one, the Statue of Liberty was created by a Freemason in France. designed and built by a Freemason in France as a gift to the Freemasons of America. And not only that, if you look at the tablet that she holds in her hand, you know what's engraved on that tablet? Just four characters, 1776, the year the Illuminati was formed, not the year America was formed. Now, we need to get on here. The next character we're going to deal with, no, this is not Santa Claus on a bad hair day. This is probably the most honored Mason in American history. His name is General Albert Pike. And this guy is one of two Masons who has the honor of being buried in the House of the Temple in Washington, D.C. You will have a lot of Masons try and tell you, because if you read Albert Pike's material, you will find out that he's an antichrist, that he's a Luciferian, that he mocks Christianity, that he denies the virgin birth, that he denies the resurrection of Jesus Christ, that he calls the early Christian fathers dunces. This is all in Morals and Dogma, the book which is virtually the Bible of the Scottish Rite. But let me tell you, there is not a more honored Mason in American history. Albert Pike was a Confederate general who, by the way, was noted for his atrocities, both against Union troops and against Native Americans. He did things that were horrible to those people he captured. Basically, they called him a fiend. Then he went on to, with General Nathan Bedford Forrest, to found the Ku Klux Klan. And he had the title of the Chief Justice of the Invisible Empire. The Ku Klux Klan is a Masonic body. Now, it's not officially a Masonic body, but it was started by a Mason. And it, to this day, it maintains many of the same characteristics of Masonry. He was the sovereign grand commander of the Scottish Rite, which meant he was the highest ranking Mason in America. He also was a supreme Luciferian pontiff, which meant he was the highest ranking Satanist in the world. He's also the author of Morals and Dogma. It was said of Albert Pike that he was the greatest Masonic philosopher of the Western and English speaking world, that he left Masonry, he found Masonry in a cabin, kind of in desolation after the anti-Masonic period of American history, and left it in a temple. He's the only Confederate general to be buried within the city limits of Washington, D.C., and he's the only Confederate general and KKK member to have a 50-foot statue in his honor within Washington, D.C.'s city limits. Now, why isn't the NAACP out picketing that, huh?
The lamp is burning low upon my tabletop. The snow is softly falling. The air is still in the silence of my room. I hear your voice softly calling. If I could only have you near to breathe a sigh or two, I would be happy just to hold the hands I love on this winter night with you.